Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
If you stepped into a courtroom in Dayton, Tennessee on a July day in 1925, you could have heard this testimony.
Your name is Howard Morgan?
Yes, sir.
You're Luke Morgan's son.
A teacher, John Scopes, was on trial for teaching young Howard and his classmates Darwin's theory of evolution.
Yes, sir.
How old are you, Morgan?
14 years.
Did you attend school?
There are lots of reasons this was called the trial of the century. You had two great attorneys, Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan, going head-to-head over science and religion. And the gist of it was, are we God's creations, or are we descended from monkeys? One of the reasons that this case became so famous is that you didn't need to be in Tennessee to follow it.
This is WGN, the voice of the people of Chicago.
This newfangled thing called radio had pretty much just been introduced, and WGN laid cables and set up microphones in the courthouse in order to bring the first live broadcast of a trial into thousands of homes. Broadcast media had arrived. And it wasn't just the radio. Newspapermen and movie camera operators flocked to the small town of Dayton, Tennessee to cover the carnival atmosphere. Monkeys dressed in suits with bow ties were brought in. Allegedly, they were set to testify. It was a big deal. Songs were written and sung by choirs.
Just explain to the jury here now, these gentlemen here in front of you, how he taught the books to you.
Well, sometimes he would ask us questions, and then he would lecture to us on different subjects in the book.
Did he ever undertake to teach you anything about evolution?
Yes, sir.
Now, to be sure, Darwin's theory of evolution introduced a radical idea. And here's how it trickled down to one high school boy in 1925.
He said that the Earth was once a hot, molten mass, too hot for planet or animal life to exist upon it. In the sea, the Earth cooled off. There was a little germ of one cell organism formed, and this organism kept evolving until it got to be a pretty good-sized animal. It came on to be a land animal, and it kept on evolving. And from this was man.
Let me repeat that.
Perhaps science trumps religion. The image of Adam and Eve as the mother and father of humankind was in danger of being obliterated from young minds.
What did he say about them?
Well, the book and he both classified man along with cats and dogs, cows, horses, monkeys, lions, horses, and all that.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, Round 2, Culture Wars. And this week, we're looking at the long battle between science, or the effort to understand our world, and political culture, which is to say, our debate over how we can live in this world together. Darwin's an even better example of that than most of us realize. We've been negotiating with his science for more than 150 years, from the moment the Origin of the Species dropped. In fact, historian Randall Fuller says even Darwin started negotiating with himself as he wrote the thing.
Darwin was very canny and cagey, initially at least, about the discussions of evolution as it applied to human beings. And he mentions the word human once in On the Origin of Species, precisely because he knew that he was likely to stir up all kinds of religious and racial debates.
Religious and racial debates. It was a twofer, because in addition to challenging the Bible, Darwin was challenging the conventional wisdom that white people evolved from a totally different and superior species than other people. So immediately after he published in 1859, the powerful and the established of that era scrambled, trying to square what the science said about our world with the way they wanted us to live in it.
After the Emancipation Proclamation, Darwin's idea actually becomes embraced by Southerners who use that notion of adaptability and survival of the fittest to suggest that white people are inherently more fit in the United States to rule and to dominate than are black people.
This is what happens. Scientific breakthroughs upset conventional wisdom, which then starts a fight to make the science support a new conventional wisdom. So what's the science we're debating today? Climate science was not up for debate back when the standard bearer of the Republican Party was George H.W. Bush.
And we cannot allow a question like climate change to be characterized as a debate between economists versus environmentalists. To say that this issue has sides is about as productive as saying that the Earth is flat.
25 years later, we are very much in negotiation with that same science. The standard bearer of the Republican Party now actually dismisses it altogether.
Well, first of all, I'm not a believer in global warming. I'm not a believer in man-made global warming. It could be warming and it's going to start to cool at some point.
So how'd that happen? How'd we go from clarity on climate science to, well, confusion? WNYC's Amanda Aronchik says this particular culture war began inside the Republican Party.
So we're going to start in 1986. Picture this. There is a group of scientists and senators, and they're assembled for a hearing. A climatologist from NASA is making a presentation. He puts up some maps, and he puts up some graphs, and he explains that there's this thing underway called global warming. The man running the session is a Republican senator from Rhode Island. His name is John Chafee, and he's clearly alarmed.
We certainly had some powerful and graphic and clearly disturbing testimony from several distinguished scientists about the nature of the problems, including the likely...
Chafee tells the crowd that he's convinced. He says this is not Chicken Little telling us the sky is falling.
I think any of you were here... I certainly found it a sobering experience.
This hearing leads to a couple of newspaper articles, but that's it. The next year, the same NASA climatologist goes back, and his second hearing, it gets even less attention than the first. So the following year, 1988, same NASA climatologist, James Hansen, and he's back again with the same message. But now he is determined to not be ignored. And there's a difference this time. The weather. 1988 is hot.
Forecasters are predicting no relief from the haze or the heat this weekend as temperatures will graze...
That summer, the country is in one of the longest and hottest droughts on record. The fields of North Dakota are so dry and cracked, it looks like the moon. Yellowstone is on fire. There's a haze over the cities.
Two things we know we probably won't be doing this weekend. One of them is watering the lawn, and the other one could be breathing. At least health officials are advising that breathing is...
Hansen supporters see the heat as an opportunity. They call the Weather Service in Washington, D.C. and ask, what day is going to be the hottest? The prediction? June 23rd.
It's all part of the continuing problems we're seeing as the heat goes on.
On that day in 1988, James Hansen makes his third presentation.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Dr. Hansen, if you'd start us off, we'd appreciate it.
Not only is it nearly 100 degrees outside, but the organizers went into the hearing room the night before and they left all the windows open. The air conditioning does not come on, and the room is hot.
I'm going to have to talk right into the microphone.
When Hansen makes his case, his forehead is shiny with sweat.
The global warming is now large enough that we can ascribe, with a high degree of confidence, a cause and effect relationship to the greenhouse effect.
In short, Hansen declares global warming
has begun.
And this time, did anybody pay attention?
Yes, this is climate change's, like, big coming out moment. It's front page news, it's in the New York Times, it's in the Washington Post, and Hansen gets invited on all of these TV shows. He brings with him these big dice that he's had made, and he's trying to say that if we keep burning fossil fuels at the same rate, we are loading the dice for more extreme weather.
And basically playing craps with our future.
That's right. So at this point in time, Americans are learning about climate change. They get the message. It's bad. And everybody believes the sweaty scientist from NASA, because why wouldn't you?
I believe them.
And so politically, climate change is just not up for debate.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very, very much.
That same year, George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., has just finished up two terms as Ronald Reagan's vice president. Now, when Reagan was president, he had so little regard for conserving energy, he had the solar panels removed from the roof of the White House. And Bush Sr., he wants to be different. He wants to be the environmental president. There's this one kind of amazing speech. It's not at all what you'd expect from a Republican who is running for president.
1988, in a sense, is the year that the Earth spoke back.
He's in Michigan, and he's standing with Lake Erie behind him.
Our land, water, and soil support a remarkable range of human activities, but they can only take so much.
That campaign year, the environment is important to voters.
I'm an environmentalist. Always have been from my earliest days.
And he always will be, he says, to his last days, and...
That is not inconsistent with being a businessman, nor is it with being a conservative.
To prove his commitment, he hires a man who is both an environmentalist and a Republican to run the EPA. I called him at his home in California a few weeks ago. Hi there, Mr. Riley.
How are you?
His name is William Riley.
Former administrator, 1989 to 93, of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Riley says one of the reasons Bush Sr. appoints him is because of suburban moms.
Their number one issue is abortion, but their second issue is the environment.
Now, Bush wants to win the election, but Riley believes he was also sincere.
Bush was an outdoors man. He loved the environment. He was comfortable in the mountains and the forest, and he hunted quail in the wilds of Texas. This was a man who had regretted the Reagan administration's low priority for the environment.
That November, George H.W. Bush wins the election, in part because he took the issue of the environment from the Democrats.
We can now speak the most majestic words a democracy has to offer. The people have spoken.
It's 4 years later, it's 1992, and climate change is back in the news.
Turning now to the global environment, at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro today, the United States indicated that it might be...
This time, it's because world leaders are preparing for the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, better known as the Earth Summit in Rio. Time magazine calls it the Summit to Save the World. It takes 2 years of planning. It's the largest and most elaborate conference ever. There are 170 governments going, more than 100 heads of state. Now, at this time, the country is not worrying about a heat wave because there is a recession underway. And the fear with Rio is that if limits are put on industry by, say, requiring a reduction in CO2 emissions, people will lose jobs. Not good in an election year. So behind the scenes, Bush Sr.'s staff fight. Some tell him that going to Rio will be humiliating, and others tell him that not going to Rio will be worse. For months, it is unclear what Bush is going to do. Now, William Riley, the Republican who's running the EPA, he wants Bush to go, but he fears the protesters.
We were very concerned about the organization of the conference and its concentration of press, likely many of them hostile to the United States.
So before the summit begins, Riley visits Rio on his own.
So I was invited by Prince Charles to sail up the Amazon on his yacht, the Britannia.
Riley goes on the yacht because he knows that all of Brazil's bigwigs, including their president, will be there too. And he's like, look, the President of the United States cannot show up to some disorganized mess.
Any kind of highly embarrassing, poorly organized affair, disruption, and the rest was a particular concern during that time.
Holding an international conference to address climate change without the United States, that's not going to work. And President Collor de Mello of Brazil, he knows it too.
And I remember President Collor looked me in the eye and said, I promise you that if President Bush comes, we will not embarrass him. We will be extremely sensitive to his situation. He said, but you have to know there are more than 60 heads of state waiting to find out whether the President of the United States is attending this conference. And they are withholding their own decision until they find out what his is.
With just 1 month before Rio, George Herbert Walker Bush finally agrees to go.
President Bush left Andrews Air Force Base near Washington, D.C. today, bound for South America. He is scheduled to attend the...
It is a massive event. Along with all the UN people, there are 10,000 journalists, 17,000 activists. And outside, there are demonstrations in the streets, as Riley feared. But there's also lots of hubbub. Celebrities turn up. There's Jane Fonda, Ted Turner, Shirley MacLaine, the Dalai Lama, Sting, Olivia Newton-John. And John Denver performs at the opening ceremony.
John Denver has been celebrating nature in his songs for years, long before the word environment became a household word.
Denver's wearing a Hawaiian shirt, and he's singing in front of the flags of the world. Behind him, there is also a small screen with images of the sea, flocks of birds, sunsets, and children.
The wind is the whisper of our mother, the earth. The wind is...
By the end of the Earth Summit, 154 countries, including the United States, sign the first climate treaty, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it becomes the framework for Kyoto and Paris and all the climate change treaties. One attendee said, "The history books will refer back to this day as a landmark in a process that will save the planet from deterioration."
Except it didn't go that way. After the break, how skepticism is born. We want to hear how this climate discussion plays out in school, how climate science is being taught. So we want to talk to two groups, parents. Has your kid ever gotten a handout saying that the warming we're seeing is just natural? Has your kid gotten info about climate change that you found puzzling? And teachers, have you been expected to teach info about climate change that was wrong? How did it go? Have you ever been confronted by students or parents who denied climate change? What did you do? Here's what one teacher told us.
Hi, this is John. I teach environmental science at a Catholic high school in Louisiana. And when it comes to climate change, what I like to do is to let the students decide with the facts rather than believe what's coming down to them being told them. But I like them to have the last word and to say why or why not they believe this is happening.
Tell us. Tweet us with the hashtag US of Anxiety. Send us a photo if you've got one of that handout or textbook, or leave us a voicemail at 1-844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We're talking about how we went from climate consensus to climate confusion. And Amanda, before the break, it sounded like we were really at this big turning point in the history of this debate.
Right. It seemed like everybody agreed. They signed this treaty. And while it didn't have teeth, it didn't force countries to reduce emissions. It did acknowledge, yes, there is a problem. And yes, the countries of the world agreed we are going to have to work together to solve it.
And is the science of this up for debate yet?
Barely. Just a little tiny bit.
But I found some seeds of it in some news clips, and I'm going to walk you through one of them. So this is from NBC. You remember Tom Brokaw?
Yes, indeed.
Turning now to the global environment. At the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro today, the United States indicated that it might be willing to accept...
This is from the very start of the Earth Summit. So this is from June 4th, 1992. And in this clip, Tom Brokaw kind of sets up the whole thing, and then he turns to his chief science correspondent, who explains the science behind climate change.
Every time we drive a car, turn on a light, manufacture a product, we use energy. And most of our energy comes from coal, oil, or natural gas.
Then there's an animation, and it shows little bubbles of CO2 floating around the Earth's atmosphere.
When these burn, they release carbon dioxide, which is invisible and odorless. But carbon dioxide lingers in the atmosphere, where some scientists believe it can act like the windows of a greenhouse, trapping more and more of the sun's heat.
Next, there's a scientist.
The world is facing the potential for record heat, record drought, forests going up in flames.
And here's the pivot. The next interview is with an owner of a coal mine.
If there's anything this country needs now, it's jobs. And precipitous action in form of legislation or international commitments will eliminate jobs in this country, and thousands of them.
Okay, so we're watching a story that is like a science report. You're talking to a scientist, we're hearing about science, and then all of a sudden, there's coal miners.
All of a sudden, there's coal miners, and they kind of set it up like, here's the other side of the debate.
But it's not the other side of the debate, because we were talking about science, and then, like, here comes a political conversation, which isn't the other side of a science debate. It's not like it's more science. It's now economics.
Kai, this is about money, right? And industry gets it. The coal, oil, gas industries, they understand the implications. People will lose jobs, and these industries will certainly lose money. So they start to bankroll think tanks and conferences and scientists, all to spread the same message, that the science behind climate change is wrong. And economics start to appear in science stories, and even weirder still, scientists appear in stories about economics.
Greenhouse warming is essentially a non-problem for all practical purposes.
S. Fred Singer is a scientist who often defends industries like coal and oil, which are less concerned about the climate than about drastic economic measures being proposed to protect it.
Anytime you try to limit the use of energy, you're really limiting economic growth.
And he is a scientist who has been used for more than one thing before. This is not his first time at the rodeo. I found old newspaper clips from Singer, quotes from his letters that he'd written to the editor, where he calls into question all sorts of things. He calls into question acid rain. He calls into question ozone depletion. He calls into question the Clean Air Act. He's basically a hired scientist contrarian who they pull out at any moment to just disagree with an issue that usually has to do with government regulation and government involvement.
To just heckle the media, to heckle the debate.
Or to call into question the debate. And some of these scientists, they worked for the tobacco industry back when the big companies were still claiming that secondhand smoke was not bad for you.
Wow, and so they went and got the same people.
Right, so the same people return for the climate change debate. Here's this guy, he is a biochemist, and he runs, quote, scientific affairs for Philip Morris Tobacco back in 1992.
Based on a careful review of the science, we believe that environmental tobacco smoke has not been shown to be a risk factor in the development of lung cancer, respiratory disease in children, or heart disease.
And in 2010, this is what the same man, Tom Borelli, has to say about climate change.
What happens when it becomes more popularly known that a lot of the science on climate change was faked?
So these early climate change deniers, they have learned their tricks from the tobacco industry. You don't have to refute all the science.
But if you can just plant a little doubt or sow a little confusion, it will take root and grow like weeds.
And that is exactly what happened. Okay. Is that Mark Morano?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Very
Meet
good.
Mark Morano, a.k.a. King of the Skeptics, a.k.a. Climate Killer. And yes, he enjoys these titles. He is in the media all the time.
Explain to me.
Well, CO2 is rising. No one's disputing that. What Bill Nye just did was waste everyone's time explaining that CO2 is rising. The question is what impact...
I called him because he is a big player in the climate change denial movement. So tell me, where were you back in 1992? What were you doing?
Very good question. In 1992, I had been managing campaigns. I was actually working for Rush Limbaugh, the television show. I was his Washington, D.C. correspondent. That was the first year of Rush
Limbaugh. Morano learned a lot working with Limbaugh. And it's around this time that he starts to question the environmental movement. To him, the Earth Summit was a disaster.
I do remember that period in time well, and I was actually upset at George H.W. Bush for legitimizing the United Nations process and actually signing that Rio Earth Summit Treaty and actually getting it ratified.
He sees the United Nations as controlling the message. They decide how bad climate change is, and then they put themselves in charge of fixing it.
This is a United Nations racket.
And he says that signing at Rio locked the United States into decades of bad UN treaties.
And George H.W. Bush handed it all to him, and from the point of view of a climate skeptic, was a disastrous president when it came to this. He set up the framework, he capitulated, he was weak, and his son, George W. Bush, was not much better.
Whoever is president at any given time has a surprising amount of impact on what is a scientific question. What do we do about climate change? Then, September 11th overshadows everything. Climate change all but disappears from political discourse until 2006. That year, Mark Morano, he goes to work for Senator Jim Inhofe, the senator from Oklahoma famous for claiming that catastrophic global warming is a hoax. It's at this moment that climate change embodies all these things that Republicans hate. Government regulation, globalism, and perhaps worst of all, Al Gore.
You look at that river gently flowing by. You notice the leaves rustling with the wind.
This is from An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's slideshow turned documentary.
A new scientific study shows that for the first time they're finding polar bears that have actually drowned, swimming long distances, up to 60 miles, to find the ice.
And not to be outdone, Mark Morano also releases his own documentary. It's called Climate Hustle. And it also has a scene about polar bears and sea ice.
Are polar bears disappearing? In 1960, as few as 5,000 polar bears roamed the Earth. Fast forward 5 decades, their population has only grown.
Why does everybody bring up the polar bears? Like, where did this come from?
Well, that's a good question. In my film, we talk about how it's the poster child because they're an iconic animal, and it appeals to kids, it appeals to everyone, and you sort of get the ooh, ah, especially a mother polar bear with the, you know, their cubs.
Polar bears are a good example of how climate change skepticism works. Yes, they are iconic animals, and both sides use their story for political gain.
Global activists, they all talk about the future. They won't talk about the fact that there are now more polar bears ever counted in the history of polar bear counting. U.S. Geological Survey said that they're at or near historic population high. We're now over 30,000 with the latest estimate. They just keep going up and up as people worry about them 50 to 75 years from now.
Now, what Morano just said seems plausible, right? He's got the U.S. Geological Survey in there.
I guess, but how does anybody know how many polar bears there are?
Exactly. So I called up the chief scientist at Polar Bears International, and he basically said the same thing. That 5,000 number, nobody really knows where it comes from. They figure it might be a wag, which is a scientific term for a wild-ass guess, because it's very hard to count polar bears.
Right.
So let's say you've got this polar bear story and you want to repeat it. How would you best go about that?
Let me guess, the media.
Sadly, the media does not do well in the story of climate change denial. I spoke with Naomi Oreskes about this. She wrote that book, Merchants of Doubt, and she's a historian at Harvard. And she reviewed thousands of papers on the subject. And she's the one who figured out there's consensus among scientists. Climate change is happening. 97% of researchers agree. But the media, we have portrayed it as a scientific debate.
This is a deliberate strategy that skeptics and deniers use if they can get the media to present skepticism as sort of equal and opposite to science and scientific evidence, then they have won.
I haven't done a climate change story before, but I can see that the reason why someone like me in public radio would have gone and interviewed someone from the other side is because I would have seen it as a partisan issue.
Bingo. Proof they've won. You see it as a partisan issue, and that's exactly what they want. But if you saw it as a scientific story that scientists had discovered something, I mean, think about it. If there were some new breaking news about a scientific discovery of a cure for AIDS, you would not feel compelled to then have the equal and opposite side of some random person at the Cato Institute who is not a scientist telling you, oh, no, they don't believe that. right? You wouldn't do that because you say, oh, this is a science story. This is about a discovery. And yet climate change has been consistently reported not as a science story, but as a partisan political story.
And this isn't just a liberal talking point. William Riley, the former administrator from the EPA and a Republican, he summed it up like this.
There was a need to sow confusion, to question the validity of the science, to say that it hadn't yet gelled. And the press went along with that, so that almost all of the stories about climate included the pros and the cons of scientific opinion, when in fact there was no significant scientific opinion questioning climate change.
Perhaps the most telling thing about the skeptics is that their views have shifted over the years. That is according to Riley Dunlap. He is an environmental sociologist. He works at Oklahoma State University, and he's watched the story adapt.
If you go back like I did in the 90s, what you find from the denial community and now the conservative community writ large is it's not warming. Then it's, well, it might be warming, but it's not humans. Well, it might be warming and we might doing a little bit, but it won't be bad. The storyline varies. As the science emerges, gets stronger, they come up with new specifics to attack it.
So now the line is climate change is happening, but the models, the data, the calculations, the predictions, all wrong.
But while the storyline changes, the bottom line always stays the same. There's no need for regulations. Any regulations would do much more harm than global warming.
This tactic works so well, it becomes part of the Republican Party platform. In fact, there's only one major political party in the world that denies climate change, and it's the Republican Party. And within the party, it has become gospel.
Global warming has become part of both Republican and conservative identity. It's right up there with God, gays, guns, abortion, and nowadays anti-immigration and anti-taxes. So if you're a good Republican, you just have to deny global warming.
Even though the number of Republicans who believe that climate change is real has been going up, it's still not a priority. In a poll from January of this year, 62% of Democrats say, yes, President Trump should make climate change a top priority, while just 15% of Republicans agree. And that's been the case for the past decade. Republicans put the issue at or near the bottom of their list. They simply do not see climate change as an important issue.
The truth of this is so alarming that it's difficult to talk about it in a way that doesn't sound hysterical. And so we're always grappling with how do you make it clear to people how serious this really is without people dismissing you as kind of insane and being an alarmist. And so honestly, I think it's rational to be alarmed about something that is alarming. If the house was burning down, we would pull the fire alarm and we would consider that rational. Well, the fact is our house kind of is burning down, but it's in this sort of slow burn, which is the burn of climate change.
And as the house burns, we negotiate with the science. Just as we did when Darwin told us humans were all of the same species. Scientific understanding of our world has once again challenged the way the established powers want us to live in it. But as we produced this story, we got to wondering why. Why science, despite all of its careful measure, is so easily manipulated and entangled in our cultural and political fights. There are probably a lot of reasons, but maybe one is that we don't have a ton of respect for science itself. Not in practice, at least. American students routinely rank poorly compared to other wealthy nations on science tests. I asked my friend Michael Falk about this. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Engineering, and because I suck at science too, I've always called him an astrophysicist.
I am a physicist. That part is correct.
I just enjoy saying that. I know an astrophysicist. But now I don't. I don't know an astrophysicist.
Technically, I'm trained as a theoretical condensed matter physicist.
What does that mean?
So it means I'm the kind of physicist who studies how condensed matter, so solids and liquids, behave.
So let me start here, Michael. I never liked science.
Okay.
It's intimidating, and it seems to always tell me things I don't want to hear. So help me understand how to like science. Do you remember a time when you were like, oh, man, this is my first love?
I think it would have to go back to fifth grade. In fifth grade, I had a teacher, and she was pretty much fearless. So the way we learned that food carries energy, she took out some, I think they were walnuts, something, and then pulled out an acetylene torch and proceeded to set the food on fire and use it to heat water, right? And I think that was kind of a moment, you know, and I think it's that engagement with the world where it's not just reading things out of books. It's actually the world is there for you to interrogate.
All these years later, Michael is part of a team of science and engineering scholars who are helping grade school kids in Baltimore have a similar scientific awakening. Because he and his colleagues note that a big part of the problem with science in the United States is it's too exclusive of a club. That not enough women and people of color and people who grow up poor get a real invitation to interrogate the world like he got.
This project is called SABES, which stands for STEM Achievement in Baltimore Elementary Schools.
They're working with about 1,300 kids. They do a bunch of classroom stuff. But the big thing is they tell them to go out in groups and look at their neighborhoods and come up with a problem for science to solve. So, of course, we had to meet some of them. We went to this year's science fair where the kids present all of their ideas to the community. And we're just going to end this episode by letting you listen to these kids talk. And thanks to reporter Stell Klein for recording these adorable conversations.
My name's Stell.
My name's Kendrick.
My name is Constance.
Okay, and how old are you guys?
Nine.
Can you tell me about your project? What's it called?
It's called the XLA 2.0.
2.0. So what is it?
It's a laser gun.
So police have these laser guns instead of regular guns?
Yes. So we can melt the regular guns that people use to kill other people and then recycle the metal to make other metal materials.
My name is Mario. I'm 10 years old.
My name's Lakaya.
What was the name of your project? Can you tell me?
The name of our project.
Pollution Solution.
Yeah. Which was very complicated to say.
Yeah.
My name's Sal.
What did you read about the weather changing or maybe climate change?
I read about climate change, about how the climate is melting the polar ice caps and how we're releasing gas and toxins in the air and it's making the wind real hot and it's melting the polar ice caps.
Oh, wow.
It makes me feel disgusting.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you find any kind of solutions or anything we can do to make it, you know, positive?
Not use cars. Like scooters, bikes, not use all these giant factories.
United States of Anxiety Culture Wars is a production of the Narrative Unit of WNYC News and WNYC Studios. Amanda Aronchek reported this story with help from Jillian Weinberger and Elaine Chin. The Narrative Unit team includes Reniqua Allen, Rebecca Carroll, Paige Cowett, and Patricia Willens. Casey Means is our technical director, with help from Bill Moss and Wayne Schulmeister. Hannes Brown is our composer, and our theme was performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Our digital team is Lee Hill, Diane Genty, and Jennifer Hsu. And a special thanks to Kofi Bonastia and WNYC's Sean Carlson for recreating the Scopes trial, and to Stell Klein for reporting in Baltimore. Jim Schachter is Vice President of News for WNYC. Jessica Miller is the Narrative Unit's producer. Karen Frillman is our executive producer. And I'm Kai Wright. Talk to you next week.
Me and Maggie think, remember when we said that so that we should make automatic cars and stuff so that we didn't have to, like, pollute the earth?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The teachers didn't get it. But what we were trying to say was that if we made automatic cars, we wouldn't have to use any gasoline, which means
save money.
And also you could save the world.